joining us. I'm Vivek Arya, Senior Semiconductor Analyst at BofA Merrill Lynch. I'm absolutely delighted to have Dan Durn, CFO of Applied Materials, and Mike Sullivan, Head of Investor Relations, joining us to kick off this afternoon session. Hopefully, everyone had a good lunch, is relaxed, and we can have a nice conversation. But please feel free to raise your hand if you have any burning questions. But what I'll do is run through a few of my questions, but we'll leave room if others have questions. So maybe, Dan, just as a start, I think you have a very unique sort of background in that you have seen many different kind of semiconductor companies, right? So you have experience at GlobalFoundries, at Freescale, NXP, and now with Applied Materials. Help us, give us a contrast of these different kinds of companies and what makes this position at Applied so much unique.
Yeah, so thanks. Probably important to just walk through the background a little bit. So before I answer, the filter that I put on things. So I got my start as an investment banker working in M&A, primarily focused on semiconductors, did about a decade with Goldman. And then I went to work in the private equity industry, primarily as an investor, running M&A and strategy, but as an investor into the semiconductor industry. And then, as you pointed out, this is my fourth operating company. First, GlobalFoundries, a customer of Applied. The next two companies, Freescale and NXP, were customers of our customers. And so I've seen all aspects of the semi industry through a pretty eclectic journey, and this is my first opportunity on the equipment side. What I would say is, in those other operating companies that I was involved in, we had influence over a sector of the industry. So whether it's automotive semiconductors or industrial semiconductors or general purpose microcontrollers, it was influence over a slice of the industry. One of the things I love about Applied is we get to make impact on an industrial scale. We're at the foundation of driving innovation into the semiconductor industry, which is on the critical path of driving innovation into the technology and other aspects, other industries. And so I think Applied is in a really unique position, and it makes this job a lot of fun to make impact on an industrial scale. I guess the other thing I would say is I think we're at a really important time in the industry where Moore's Law is beginning to slow down. Even Intel will talk about this in their earnings calls. At a time when materials is becoming increasingly important to driving roadmaps, at a time when the need for more powerful compute and better storage and better memory, at a time when the demands on the industry have never been greater, Moore's Law is slowing down. So I view us as the perfect platform at the right time in a really important time in this industry. And I guess the second thing is, I moved away from the Valley for a while, and now that I'm back, I was only gone for a few years, and the change in that time has been very dramatic. You can't drive down the street in the Valley without seeing the autonomous drive vehicles passing you on the street. You talk to the software engineers and the hardware engineers, and innovation is back in the Valley because they see the constraints that the industry used to take for granted are becoming more and more, and we're solving them in different ways. We're getting to new architectures. There's a renaissance of architecture design again. And so it's just a very exciting time to be back in the Valley, and I can't think of a better company than Applied Materials.
Great. One thing, as I started covering semi caps more, right, been covering semis for a while, one thing that I've noticed is that 5 or 6 years ago, semiconductors were all asked the question, right? You were also cyclical. Why do you deserve higher multiples? And then we went through a period of consolidation, and now we have seen semiconductors re-rate, right? Now, people are not as worried about the cyclicality, right, in semis. Like, people are more willing to believe this time it's different. Yet, when I look at the semi cap industry, which has consolidated substantially, people are not yet giving this industry the benefit of doubt. Why is that, and what needs to change?
Yeah, so I still think that investors worry that this industry hasn't fundamentally changed from a decade or 15 years ago, at a time when our customer base wasn't consolidated. In memory, you had 10, 12 market participants pursuing the same opportunity. The economic pool was defined by the PC. and you had a very cyclical boom-bust cycle every 3 years. You'd wait for the new operating system to come out. You'd flood the market with new microprocessors to drive the new operating system, and the memory would follow. Ping compatibility between device types, different suppliers of DRAM, different suppliers of storage, very commodity-like approach to that supply chain. Today, the PC industry is 20% of the industry. The handset is 30-35% of the industry. You've got the data center, the hyperscalers. You've got industrial demand for semiconductors. The diversification of our end markets have evolved, creating very different behavior patterns in the industry. And you know, to get the semiconductor industry structurally larger than it is today, hard to get there without the manufacturing capacity put in place to drive that growth. In the industry, it took us 3.5 decades to get the first $200 million or $200 billion of revenue, and that was 2020, or the year 2000. Then it took us 1.7 decades to get the next $200 billion of revenue. That was 2017. The next $200 billion of revenue probably comes in 6, 7, 8 years. And so the rate of adding that incremental growth to the semiconductors is reflective of just how important the industry is becoming. Hard to get there without the manufacturing capacity put in place. You know, and maybe this dates me, but, you know, cartoons from growing up, you've got the Jetsons and you've got the Flintstones. I think we're far more Jetson-like going forward, which stresses and underscores the importance of semiconductors versus being like the Flintstones. And so I'm encouraged by what I see. I think the industry is evolving, and I think eventually investors will begin to appreciate how things are different from a PC-centric view of the world.
I see. And when we look at semi-cap, so WFE versus, say, semiconductor sales, you know, the ratio has been as low as, you know, single digit, right, to 16%. Now it's about 12% or so. Is that a sustainable level? Do you see it going up or down from these kind of levels conceptually? Like, if let's say investors just find it easier to model semiconductor industry, can they just take that and then apply this simple formulation to it?
I think there is a construct that will hold over time. I think the world that we're operating in is more complex than it used to be. It is harder to deliver leading-edge technologies. It is harder to deliver 64-layer NAND than it is 32, and it's harder to deliver 96 or 128-layer NAND than it is 32. DRAM, you're not getting what you used to out of bit shrinks. You're increasingly adopting logic-like transistor structures around the periphery of the memory. And so the industry is getting harder. I think you can make an argument that that 12% should rise over time. But even if you keep it constant at 12, it was 9% in 2013 after the industry worked through all of the efficiency gains. It bottomed at 9%, the efficiency gains of 300 millimeter transition. Even if you say it comes down from where we are, I think you can make arguments that it goes up. But let's say it's 10%, and let's say the semiconductor industry gets to $700, $800 billion. Our industry will need to go structurally larger to get manufacturing capacity in place to support that broader industry growth. So I like where we sit right now. I like the importance of the semiconductor industry, and the capital equipment industry is on the critical path of enabling that growth.
Got it. And over the last few years, you have started to provide essentially, you know, sort of 2-year rolling forward estimates of where you think WFE. What led to that decision? And when you come up with a 2-year plan, sort of what goes into it? Because, you know, the next question is going to be, well, you said this, this is what has happened, what does it mean for next year? But I just want to understand the basic formulation. What led to the formulation of this 2-year, you know, what are the inputs that go into that?
Yeah. So let me just take a couple minutes and clarify some commentary, because I think coming out of our last earnings call, there was a bit of confusion as to what we meant by the 100 billion. So we'll go into a little bit of that history, then talk about going forward. So about 4 or 5 months ago, we started providing a directional guide on 2018 and 2019. And I'll go into the history about this in a little bit, but what we did not mean by that directional guide was 2018 plus 2019 is exactly $100 billion. Not $1 more, not $1 less. That's not what we meant. What we did not mean is if this year is 52, next year's 48. That's not what we meant. What we mean is that we see the fundamentals of 2019 continuing strength that we're experiencing today. If I have to take the over under on 100 billion, I'm definitely taking the over. Do I think WFE begins with a five handle next year? I do. And based on conversations we're having with customers, we're expecting 2019 to be up on 2018. So we feel really good about the fundamentals going into 2019. So then you ask the question, why do we provide that directional guide over a two-year period? It's because this industry has a history. And it's a history that investors know really well. The industry historically would rise to $35 billion, and the next year it would be a hard reset, on average down greater than 20% the next year. We saw that happen in the year 2000. We saw that happen in the year 2007, and we saw that happen again in the year 2011. The interesting thing is it happened again in 2016, and that cycle was broken. In revenue, the market didn't go down in 2017. It actually went up, and it went up fairly strongly to over $48 billion. And this year is up on 17, and it's across all device types. Foundry is strong, NAND is strong, DRAM is strong, logic is strong. It was like that last year. It's like that this year. It's going to be like that again next year. So we feel really good about the way the industry is evolving. End markets are diversifying. Spend is increasingly driven by non-consumer discretionary parts of the market. And we like what that means for long-term sustainability of where we are. So there's a fundamental evolution that the old way of thinking about our industry, peak at 35, hard reset the next year, that fact pattern is changing, and the directional guide is only a construct to say we see fundamentals good into 19. When 16 was a good year, everybody worried about 17. 17 was a good year, everybody worried about 18. 18's a good year, everybody worries about 19. And we're just trying to stretch the time horizon to say we see this continuing into 2019 and a follow-through on the strength we see this year. That was the intent. But we wanted to sharpen our commentary to let people know what we really meant.
Absolutely. At what point can the industry say whether next year could actually be an up year or a down year? Right? It could be above 50, but this year I think people are talking about 52, 53-ish or so.
Yeah, so I know how we're planning our business. Let's talk in a year. We're planning our business for it to be an up year. The conversations we have with customers indicate that there's going to be follow through. We're going to see growth into 2019. Well, let's talk in a year.
Right. You know, and Vivek, you know, one thing to think about is, oh, we have a question here from Sean. Okay. You know, another thing is, you know, so what drives the market, right? What drives the growth? What drives it down? That's worth thinking about, right? So, you know, if you take a step back, you know, as Dan said, when we were volatile, it was the PC industry, right? And so average WFE back then was $25 billion. Year-to-year variability, one standard deviation was $8 billion. Okay? Right. That's the old semi-cap that you knew. Then in 2010, when the smartphone came in, we then had a device that actually had more semiconductor content than the PC. People didn't realize that at first because the device is so small, but it actually did. Right. And so you end up to a higher WFE, and the variability dropped to $3 billion. And as a percent of the revenue, it's a lot lower. And now we're in this new domain because what we're seeing is we're seeing this third layer of computer that's being computing built on top of that, right? The Internet of Things, big data, cloud. And we're really just at the beginning of that when you think about it, right? So, you know, our 200 millimeter systems business is going crazy, and our trailing edge 300 millimeter business is as big as our leading edge 300 millimeter business because people want to build sensors. They want to put automation into everything. So every product built by GE or, you know, any industrial company has microprocessors, has Wi-Fi, every industrial application has these things. And so we're just at the beginning. So what we're expecting then is even higher demand potentially, we think, even lower variability. And it kind of makes sense. And so you just have to say, well, what's your view of the world? What do you think? And when we talk to customers, what they say is, well, we believe in big data. We see these sensors being deployed. We think that data will grow 25% compound into the future. Many people believe that. And at exactly the time that data is growing, Moore's Law is slowing.
Right.
Okay, so that's an opportunity, and we don't have big wafers anymore. You remember that in the old days of what happened is that every shrink cost more, but then every five nodes, the customers would move to a bigger wafer size, and they'd get a bunch of chips for free. That phenomenon stopped. The 10-nanometer node was supposed to be a 450 node. The 7-nanometer node was supposed to be a 450 node. So the capital intensity was supposed to have ratcheted down. That hasn't happened.
Nice.
So we're finding lots of clever ways to keep the roadmap going, but it's hard. So anyway, those are just some of the demand reasons why, you know, you have to have a point of view and you have to plan your business, as Dan said, for growth in 19, because that's what the customers say. You better be ready.
Got it. Is it fair to think that this year, perhaps, you know, we have seen a little bit of moderation, as you know, you pointed out, some of your peers have pointed out, because of high-end smartphones, that perhaps more of this growth is being pushed out to next year, as an example. So instead of having a big spike this year and a down year next year, perhaps you have a little more stability. Is that a reasonable way to think about spending?
Yeah, I do think it's reasonable. As we, you know, think about this year is a really good year with strength across all device types. We see the memory market up a bit into this year. We see the foundry logic business flat to up a little bit. Foundry's down a little bit year over year. But last year was an all-time record in the industry. This year is likely to be the second best year on record in the foundry industry, despite the fact that it's down a little bit. Logic is up nicely year over year. DRAM is up nicely year over year. And on our last earnings call, we talked about high-end smartphones. We talked about the ripple we're going to see in Q3 as it relates to the NAND market. But when we take a step back and we look at the year NAND had last year, this year is on par with it. So 2 quarters ago, we would have expected 40 to 45% bit growth into that market.
Right.
And right now, we see it being 40%. So really strong year, but the behavior of the customer, demand-led investments, balancing the supply-demand as opposed to overshooting the way things occurred in the past, I think are really healthy indicators for the long-term health and stability of the industry. I'm encouraged by the behavior that we see, and I like the behavior of our consolidated customer base and the discipline with which they're operating their businesses.
Got it. So one of the, you know, prominent customers, Micron, recently mentioned that they think just technology transitions can help them deliver the bit growth, that they don't need to really, you know, go and process more wafers. So without being customer specific, what do you think over the next, you know, handful of years is the role being played by tech? If, let's say, technology transitions are able to deliver the bit growth and I don't need to process more wafers, what does that mean for Applied?
Yeah, so that kind of runs counter to what we've seen play out in the industry. Whether we take NAND, DRAM, foundry, we're seeing a different dynamic play out. In DRAM, we were at 1.1 million wafer starts per month for probably a half a dozen years. All bit growth was driven by shrinks. And whatever you would lose in terms of output from factories, you would backfill, because it's more process intensive, you would backfill with greenfield adds and keep it exactly 1.1 million wafer starts per month. What happened in 2017? To get that same bit growth, it actually ticked up to 1.2 million wafer starts per month. And this year, I don't know if it rounds to 1.3 or stays at 1.2, but we see the same thing playing out. And what's happening in the industry, and I think Micron said a fair amount about this, you're getting less and less bit growth from shrinks, which means you need more greenfield adds to drive the 20% growth into the DRAM market. You see the same thing happening from a NAND perspective. You get bit growth from growing more layers and conversion of planar to 3D, but you're seeing wafer starts per month being added to make sure you're meeting the market demand for bit growth. In foundry, we see a diversification of spend. It used to be 90% on the leading edge, and there would be big chunks of capacity that get added every 2 years or so on the leading edge. Today, that spending has evolved. It's no longer 90-10. It went to 80-20. Then it went to 60-40. Now it's 50-50. And with the proliferation of edge compute devices supporting the Internet of Things, some of these more mature nodes are great landing spots for technology. 28 nanometers is a great node for our industry. We used to think it peaks at 330,000 wafer starts a month. And that was probably a couple years ago. We then went to 360, then we went to 400. Today we think that node peaks at about 500,000 wafer starts a month. So we're beginning to see growth across multiple nodes diversify. So I think what we see out of the industry reflects a different dynamic than bit growth solves all problems. Moore's Law is delivering less than it used to.
Got it. So if, let's say, next year we again have, you know, somewhat of a mediocre, you know, growth in high-end smartphones, right, in a scenario, you think in that situation NAND spending still needs to grow?
So NAND is going to need to grow.
Right.
And so right now we think it's going to be 40% bit demand growth for the foreseeable future. If that 40% goes to 35%, I don't think it goes to zero. If it goes to 35%, you're going to see a very strong NAND year. Driving growth in a vertical world is capital intensive and it's expensive. And so if growth resets materially, and I don't see a scenario where that happens, then I think you could see that ripple through in a significant way to spending. But as long as there is a structural demand for power-efficient storage, the SSD market is, if prices come down, is a huge source of elastic demand for storage that's not being tapped into today. And so I think the fundamentals of that market remain healthy, even if the high end of the smartphone market has its another weak cycle.
Mm-hmm. And then the other thing to think about is the not only the unit growth, but what's the content in devices, right? So if the smartphone stabilized and there were no performance improvements or no, then yeah, you might have an issue in terms of memory. But what we've really been seeing is a lot of content growth. And so you're seeing it now. I think Micron did a good job of laying this out. Today, a high-end smartphone might have 256 gigs of NAND. They believe the next flagship phones will be a terabyte. And that makes sense because you've got multiple cameras, you've got AR, you've got things like 3D sensing of the environment. Neural processors are being designed into these devices, so the smartphone is becoming an edge device. So a lot of those things are continuing. And it's a little like the TV market, which it plateaued in units, but the size kept growing. So we have those phenomena where you need to think past the unit growth and also think about the content growth.
Got it. Then lastly, what are the assumptions regarding the mix between planar and 3D over the next year to 2 years that we should be making?
Sure. If we snap a chalk line on where we exited 2017, you had about 1.5 million wafer starts per month in NAND, half planar, half vertical. Exiting 2018, you probably have 1.6 million wafer starts per month. Probably two-thirds of that's vertical, one-third planar. If we roll the clock forward to 2019, I think it's 1.7 million wafer starts per month, probably 80% vertical, 20% planar. Into 20, it's probably 90-10. And so we still have several years left on the conversion to vertical NAND. But once it all goes vertical, I really like this setup in that industry, because if you put in a slug of equipment to produce 32 layers, you get X bits out. You put that same level of investment in to do another 32 layers, and you get 2X the bits out. Here's the interesting thing. Make that same level of investment again, and you don't get 100% growth, you get 50% growth.
Right.
And then the same investment, you get 33% growth. And so the capital intensity to drive growth in a vertical world goes up over time, and I think that sets us up really well.
Got it.
That's a great point. It's the inverse of Moore's law shrinking, right? Instead of it being a continual geometric, it slows down.
Got it. Yeah. Your display business, so recently you said this year will be fine, but next year there will be reset or reprofiling of the business. Do you think the display expectations are adequately reset, or are there still pluses or minuses that we should be aware of?
Yeah, so I think, you know, look, we had a pretty good reset of, I think, expectations around that business. Display business is a great business for us. Since 2012, this is a business that's grown at a compound annual rate of 25% from 2012 to 2017. From 17 to 18, it grew another 30%. So a great business for us. And it is exposed to two different device types, TVs and handsets. And the OLED penetration is an important driver for our display business. So you see 2019 reprofiled, and I think it was a de-risked view of 2019, and then you see 2020 recovering to a level above where we are in 2018. So we still feel good about the business, and we feel good fundamentally about the OLED technology being the technology of choice in handsets. From a technical standpoint, you've got greater pixel density, better refresh rates, and lower power consumption. And then when you think about roadmaps, I don't have my cell phone with me, but it's a great device. Our hands aren't getting any bigger, and so it's a device that fits nicely in your hands. But the limiter is the user interface of the screen. And so when you can enable things like foldable displays, it changes the user experience around that device in pretty fundamental ways. And you can't implement that roadmap with an LCD technology. So for a whole host of technical reasons, OLED will come to the handset. When you look at it economically, the cost entitlement of that screen is better than an LCD screen. So you have an economic incentive to get there at high volume manufacturing. You've got the technical benefits. For those two reasons, we see it coming to the handset. And our view and vision on that hasn't changed. You see the evolution of the Apple lineup. One phone last year, OLED. Two phones this year. Speculation on what that roadmap is in 2019. And so for a variety of reasons, we think that that market evolves to OLED technology. I think the rate limiter on adoption today is the fact that you've got one supplier of the technology in the market, and the economic entitlement of that screen is not realized. We need competition from a supply standpoint. Once you get more than one supplier, I think you get to an equilibrium that reflects economic entitlement and adoption proliferates. So we feel good about where that market's going long term.
And I think in the past you had given $3.5-ish billion number for fiscal 20 for display. I know things are now at a different. When will you get a sense of when you can hit that trajectory? Is that a 21, 22? Type of number, or is it too early to?
Yeah, so we gave you a sense of how 19 and 20 profile. We've got an analyst day coming up in October.
No preview of.
we'll do work on that between now and then, and tell people what we think.
Yeah,
it'll be our best view on the market.
Yeah, and an important consideration too is that, you know, what we had in our model, which, you know, we stand by, is a revenue level for things that are beyond semi equipment, and that's a combination of display and the services business. And when you add the two of them up, they're actually, you know, they're very different markets. And to the extent that the display business is lower due to the delay of the OLED transition, the services business is a lot stronger.
Right.
So when you net it out, you know, you're in a great place.
Right. I'm glad you brought up services, because as you know, I was looking at right, the business models for, you know, equipment companies, that seemed to me, you know, very attractive part, because nobody in semiconductors talks about services. Right, and yet you have, right, an industry where services is becoming an important part. So help us unpack what is in your services business, what are the one-offs in it, and what are the more sustainable parts of your services business?
Yeah, so as we take a look at services, think about it as, you know, parts and labor. Think about it as helping customers with really complex problems, performance related contracts associated with our install base, and then our 200 millimeter systems business is reported as part of that segment. When we take a step back, this is a business that when Gary came in had a very different, when Gary came in a handful of years, had a very different philosophy on what the future of this business could be for our company. We've got new leadership and a new philosophy of how to operate the business, and they've done a great job executing over time. The three vectors of growth: install base. We have the largest install base in the industry. We talk about complexity with Moore's Law hitting a wall. Complexity in the industry is increasing. That benefits that business well. And then when we look at service agreements associated with tools, this is an opportunity versus, say, a tool that's not on a contract to get a potential 4 to 10x uplift on service over the life of the tool. And we share in the benefit of better performance of that tool. Mm-hmm. Customers' ROI goes up, factory operates at a more efficient point, so the economic uplift for the customer is huge, and we share in a bit of that upside. And so we really like the setup around the business. I guess the last thing in terms of that business going forward, you know, think about buying a new car. You buy a car, it usually comes on warranty. Car has a problem, take it to the dealer. Dealer fixes the car, gives it back to you. Our tools are very similar. For the first 12 months, they're under warranty. We take care of any problems. After that, the tool then becomes an adder to our services business. And we've got the largest install base in the industry. We had record shipments in 2017, record system shipments again in 2018. And so I like the setup on that business going forward. We feel really good about that business.
Got it. Do you think it would help investors to get a sense for a services backlog number, you know, sort of like software companies do?
More visibility is, from an investor standpoint, is always good. You know, we also have a business to run to, and so we got to balance transparency to create credibility around not only the management team as well as the portfolio of businesses we have, but we don't want to be overly transparent from a competition or customer standpoint sometimes. And so it's that balance. Is more from an investor perspective always better? I'm sure they would say yes. But from running a business standpoint, sometimes there are certain things we want to keep to ourselves so that we can execute on a strategy and drive long-term value creation and success in the market.
But is that a number you track internally? And did you see that number go up a lot in 17 and now in 18, because you know the industry has inflected substantially in the last 2 years? Mm-hmm.
Let me answer the question without answering it.
You can answer it.
I really like the setup of our business. I think we've dialed in an operating model. We've got great leadership driving that business going forward, and I really like the setup around that business going forward for a variety of reasons.
Yeah. And one thing, Vivek, is it's probably the easiest business to model. You know, you can look at it, and you can also look for some leading indicators. So what we did do, and we, you know, maybe we'll do it again at the analyst meeting this year, but we talked about how many tools in the installed base and how many are under service agreement, and we showed the year-to-year increase over that. So that's helpful. And then as Dan said, you know, in that first year when we're taking care of that tool at our cost, well, you know, we're shipping record tools this year. So that means next year they'll be in the base again. So barring something that happens in the industry that brings fab utilization levels down worldwide, why wouldn't it be, you know, continue to be a good business? So that's nice. It should be pretty easy. And now we're, you know, we're practically $1 billion a quarter.
Right. And that's where I was going with it, right, Mike? Thanks yeah. for in that. If let's say WFE continues to do its plus and minus, right, this year, every other year, but you have this sort of almost secularly growing, you know, piece under that, right? That's almost 20% of the industry growing at sort of double digit, right? Mid-teens kind of pace. That can actually help withstand the volatility of WFE, yeah, right, on an annual basis. That's a pretty powerful message, I imagine.
And then the other thing you can think about is, you know, if you think about the 200 millimeter systems business that's in that group, right, those are older tools, right? These are tools that could be 15, 20 years old. And who are the customers? You know, you think about WFE and you think it's consolidated, right? We're selling mainly to a handful of customers. when we sell those systems, the reason it's in the hands of the sales force, the services force, is because they're dealing with thousands of end customers. They're in automotive, industrial. They travel the world in those places because that's who needs those. They're actually still selling 6-inch wafer tools. And where they're selling, and they're also responsible for a lot of the 300 millimeter tools that are on the trailing nodes, because those are now selling to thousands of end applications in those diverse markets. So really things have broadened quite a bit more than you would think when you normally look at WFE.
Got it. Mm-hmm. Question, Dan, on China. So they have become an important source of growth for the industry. Obviously, the trade tensions tonight don't help that. Hopefully, those are resolved. But as you look at China, at what point should investors start to worry that can that be a source of a lot of capacity that ends up hurting the industry?
Yeah, so I think we have to disaggregate things like press releases and what actually happens on the ground. Sometimes press releases don't always accurately reflect plans. And so what I would say about it is I think China is going to be a meaningful player in the semiconductor industry 2 decades from now. And this stuff takes time. It's very hard and it's very difficult. It's orders of magnitude harder, orders of magnitude harder than something like solar. And the strategic intent of China is very clear, and the financial resources are there. But the behavior we see today is realistic in terms of expectations, and we see capacity adds actually being modest. And we see China taking a long-term perspective on the industry. We see ecosystem building today. We see pilot lines going in. We see technology development happening. And we see building of human capital. All of the foundational elements of a healthy industry. We don't actually see significant capacity adds for a handful of years, 2021, 2022, 2023. They need to get the foundation of the industry built first. Where we do see, actually, let me take a step back. In terms of spending, we see the domestic providers and the multinationals being roughly balanced. We saw that last year. We see that again this year. We see it again next year, with maybe a slight weighting towards multinationals next year. And so the spending is balanced and reflects that long-term view. Where we see capacity going in, it's more on the foundry side and it's more on trailing node geometries. And we don't see China domestic providers on the leading edge of either foundry logic or memory anytime soon. They're just taking a very pragmatic approach to building this industry. And I think that sets them up well for long-term health and growth.
Got it. Let me pause and see if there are any questions from the audience. Sean.
Just two questions. Going back, first of all, to the display side, do you need foldable handsets to really ramp in 2020 for you to kind of see calendar 2020 spending levels above calendar 18? That's the first. And then the second, on the silicon side, do you see, is your visibility into kind of calendar 19 better, worse than it was about this time a year ago?
I would say, let's answer them in reverse order. We see about the same level of visibility in the semi-systems business a year ago versus what we see today. Very similar dynamic. From a display standpoint, we do not need foldable devices in the 2020 timeframe to drive the dynamic that we talked about. In fact, that roadmap has a number of technical challenges that I think take longer than that time frame to work through. I think it's probably a handful of years away, maybe 4 years, if they're good at solving some problems, a handful of years away before you start seeing those types of devices, not in a one-off format, but volume manufacturing. Mm-hmm.
Okay. And just the last question, Dan, in the 2 minutes that we have left. In terms of margins, you're already at your target 47%, right, 29.6% op margin. How much more leverage is in the model?
So if we take a look at, break it out into gross margin and operating margin, gross margin 5 points in 5 years. Company's done a really good job driving gross margins. Clearly, we have a portfolio of businesses, and we have a gross margin spread across those businesses. I would say semi-systems is above the corporate average. Display and services are below the corporate average, in that order. And if you look at the growth rates, we talked about service being a strong driver. Display has been a strong driver to date. They'll be down year over year next year, recovery into 2020, but still a strong grower and probably above semi-systems. That creates a natural headwind for gross margin progression. It's something we're hyper-focused on. And if there are opportunities to drive gross margins higher, we're absolutely going to capture that and deliver that to shareholders. But there's a profiling of our business that creates a natural headwind. From an OPEX standpoint, in 2013, we were 28.3% OPEX to sales. Exiting 17, it was 18.3%, so 10 points of leverage over that time. Company's done a great job of driving growth in an efficient way. We'll be down again into 2018 off of those levels. But, you know, we'll probably show some incremental leverage going forward, but clearly the rate of driving that leverage is going to change going forward. I think we feel good about our ability to drive value for shareholders. The company's done a great job over the last handful of years. I think we'll continue to do a great job. We'll talk more about the long-term model at our Analyst Day in a couple months.
Great. Terrific. Thank you so much, Stan.
Thanks for your time.
Appreciate it.
Thanks,
everyone.